Hi, this is David Asola, and you're listening to Whatever Nevermind.
Welcome to Whatever Nevermind, people, a Cobras and Fire endorsed sidecast. My name is Baco, of course. I just want to give you a little heads up here. We have a special interview, kind of a bonus to this week's Alice in Chains facelift episode. David DeSola is the author of Alice in Chains, The Untold Story. It's one of the only books out there you can find that is this detailed and gives you all kind of the backstory of Alice in Chains. It kind of gives you some of the dirt, no pun intended, without being too, I don't know, nefarious at the same time. It's a very, very fun read if you're a fan of rock biographies as I am. We talk all about the facelift era stuff, and of course we get into Dirt, which is a record coming up further down the list. So I'm going to split the interview up into two parts. Today you're going to hear us talk mainly about the era surrounding facelift. Further on down the list, when we eventually get to the Dirt record, I'll share the other half, which you'll enjoy just as much as this one, if not more. But both halves of the conversation are a really fun chat. Dave was a great guy, gave us a lot of time, and like I said, if you're a fan of rock biographies, this is one of the best about a band that doesn't have a lot written about them. So if you're an Alice in Chains fan and you like rock biographies, you should probably go out and get this right now if you haven't already. Enjoy. To welcome to the program, David DeSola, author of the Alice in Chains, The Untold Story. This book's been out a while, and it's basically available everywhere. David, thank you for your time, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell me a little bit about yourself as far as, like, you don't have a whole lot of rock biographies in your resume here. How did you end up coming to be the author for this book? I guess we'll start there.
Basically, in the summer between first and second year of grad school at Georgetown, I had a summer job of 60 minutes, and I was doing class two nights a week. So basically, I had a lot of homework. That's what I'm trying to get at here. So one of those nights where I'm, you know, up late reading whatever, I put on the Dirt album for the first time in like years probably, and it kind of just sort of, I rediscovered it basically. It's kind of like, wow. Right?
Sure.
And so I listened to it, you know, all the way through, start to finish. And when it was over, I was like, well, you know, it's 2011, you know, Wayne's been dead for a while now. You know, somebody must have written a book on him or something. So I go on Google, I go on Amazon, I go on all the usual sources, and I find nothing along the lines of what I was looking for. So at that point, I had the utterly insane idea of doing it myself. Besides having a day job and summer school, right? So, I finished the summer term, you know, my summer gig is 50 minutes, finished my classes, and then I had about 3 or 4 weeks off before the start of the fall term. So at that point, I did my first trip to Seattle, I did my first round of interviews and field research, and then I was like, okay, well, do this book and see what happens. And so, you know, I juggled the book in grad school for pretty much my entire second year. I finished school and then I did the book full time, and you know, there you go, that's it. But basically, long story short, to answer your question, I was looking for a book that didn't exist, and then I decided to do it myself.
So this is very much a passion project for you then?
Mm-hmm. A passion project, a challenge.
Okay.
You know, it was the right place at the right time. You know, I had the skill set, I had the motivation, I had the time, I had the resources, thankfully. and just all these sort of things going on in my life at the same time, and it all just sort of happened to work in my favor, and I was like, okay, I'm going to do this.
Break that down, because I love getting to kind of the more nerdy kind of behind the scenes stuff. When you say the resources, what do you mean?
Free time, obviously. I mean, I was doing school and I was doing this. So, I mean, it was a lot of, you know, I had office space, I had, you know, time, and it's okay. Like, you know, I was doing one, I was doing the other. There was a lot of, I did a lot of records requests. I don't know if you noticed the footnotes. Those took time and money. So it's like, you know, what can you learn in any investigative reporting project is if you need any documents requests, any public records requests, get those things in early because they can take, they can take you a few days, they can take you a few months. So ultimately, you know, over the 3 years I was working on this project, I came up with something like 14 or 15 binders worth of documents. And, you know, they'll take up quite a bit of shelf space, let's put it that way. On top of that, you know, I had a, you know, technology was there, you know, digital recording to do my interviews. You know, I was finding people through social networks, through networking, like just as the more I met sources, the more I got more names. Found people through social networks. I found people through the internet, you know, through, you know, whatever. I did, you know, in a perfect world, I would have moved to Seattle to do this book. I couldn't do that.
Okay.
But I did fit in I think 5 trips total in 3 years. Hmm. And I was there for like, you know, a week or so at a time. So it was like, you know, when I was in on the ground in Seattle, I would me do or see or get while I was physically there. Because it's like, if I could get an interview on the ground while I was there, it was like, great, let's do it over the phone. You know, worst case scenario. I can always do that. So it was, like I said, it was, you know, time, motivation, energy, resources, ego, all those things were keeping to the mix.
So you had no like advance budget to do this with? This is really just all on your own dime?
Did it on my own dime. I'd never written a book before. So I made the very silly mistake of trying to shop around the book without really knowing what I had at the very beginning. And not surprisingly, I didn't get very many encouraging responses. So I was like, fine, I just decided, okay, well, I'm going to write this thing first and shop it around when it's done or close to being finished. So I worked on it after that point. After about 2 years of working on it, I interviewed one of my sources, and the source, after the interview, the source asked me if I had a publisher, and I said, no, I was going to write, and I was going to write it and then shop it around. And she's like, well, you know, talk to my literary agent, he might be interested in this. And I said, okay, sure. And, you know, long story short, you know, this person had to pass, but he referred me to one of his colleagues who later became my agent. And, you know, he liked the piece and he shopped it around. And, you know, within a month or so of shopping around, he had an offer. So it was like, okay, at that point, I signed the contract. I'm like, oh, crap, it's real. You know, I mean, yeah. I got 12 months to turn this thing in. But, you know, so it was one of those things where it was just very sort of fortuitous. I was prepared to go self-publishing route if necessary, but ultimately I didn't have to.
Cool.
So it was, you know, one of the many resources that I was referring to in my earlier responses was, you know, besides time, was money. I was able to self-fund this thing, the entire thing that I could do. I could spend as much or as little as I wanted, depending on what the, you know, was. I'm not saying like I booked a month stay at the, you know, at the W Hotel in downtown Seattle, but I mean, if I needed, you know, one big expense that I think ultimately saved me a lot of time in the end was hiring a transcription service to log all the interviews. Because if you do a 1 hour interview, it takes you an hour just to listen to it. My experience is usually takes you double that to transcribe it, to do a really good transcription. The longest combined set of interviews I did with one subject was Jim Elmer, Wayne's stepfather.
Okay.
And he clocked in at about, in multiple sessions, he clocked in at about 5.5 hours. So do that math, right? It takes me about, you know, 5.5 hours would take you about 11 hours just to transcribe that. No, thank you. I hired a transcription service to do it for me, and, you know, it saved me a lot of time, even though it did drive up my budget, but it was a worthwhile expense in the end. So otherwise, I'd probably still be writing it.
Well, you don't have to tell me about transcribing interviews, but yeah, that's an awful lot.
I mean, I did that for years in my career, you know, CNN, 15 minutes, whatever. I mean, it's one of those thankless parts of journalism, you know, whether it's like a 5-minute interview or like a 1 hour in-depth thing for like a documentary or something. So yeah, it's not fun.
And I should mention, I think the book is killer. And you're not wrong that there wasn't shit for Alice in Chains books out there. The only one I can remember, because I am a fan. I am of both books and Alice in Chains, you know. So this was really pretty much catered to a guy like myself. But there was a book about Mike Starr, but it was so poorly written. It was
terrible, yeah. It's out of print.
Of course.
I got a copy of it on Amazon for like $80. I'm not proud of it, but I had to.
Well, part of your research.
Exactly. And it wasn't that great. I mean,
it's like a ninth grader who headed the Mike Starr fan club wrote it.
Well, he's a journalist, and the problem is he was a fanboy. He got paid to write this book, and
yeah.
And then he went to a vanity, they went the self-publishing route. And then unfortunately, you know, I don't, I'm not going to question the guy's ethics, but I wasn't able to speak to him. But, you know, Mike Starr, let's just say he wasn't the most reliable narrator. So I think he just sort of took everything Mike Starr told him in whatever state of,
it's kind of shocking because typically heroin junkies are pretty honest with me.
Oh, yeah. Well, now that we're on the subject, I'll say this. You know, Mike Starr, Blaine, Demery, anybody who had their issues with that drug, they set me down multiple rabbit holes over the years, let's put it that way. So that's what I learned. You know, the old, you know, trust but verify, but for junkies, you know what I mean? So it was, you know, trying to get it, but it's like sometimes, you know, I don't know. It's almost like mathematical certainty that, you know, junkies lie, you know what I mean? And I learned that the hard way. I'd spent like, you know, days or a week or however long it was trying to find a lead, and I just couldn't check it out. On the other hand, some of them did. So it was just one of those things where there was no absolute rule. But if after a while I couldn't find somebody or anything that would sort of corroborate it, I would have, like, here's one that was true.
Yeah.
Mike Starr told a friend of his that I interviewed about a story that he was in Brazil on that last tour with the band before he got fired. I guess he got withdrawal or something, but he was in a helicopter and opened a door and he flew up outside a helicopter in his flight. And so he told his friend of his, and I'm like, that sounds a little far-fetched, but I'm like, okay, fine. One of my key sources was Mike's bass tech, you know, who was there for pretty much from 90 to 96. So from the first Alice tour for Facelift to Unplugged, that was his last show. So he was there for the whole heyday of the band, that classic early period, right? And he stayed on after Mike started laughing. So I asked him about this because he was in Brazil for that tour. And I was like, oh, yeah, that happened. I was there. I was there. I was there. I was there.
All right.
So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, some of it is, you know, probably taken to be true. And some of it actually checks out. And, you know, like I said, there's no iron rule for it. You just got to try and check it and, you know, hope for the best, and sometimes you have to cut your losses, even if you spent, you know, days or weeks, you know, trying to run something down.
Oh, that is one of the things about the book I like a lot, though. I think you do an excellent job of separating verified fact from things that are probably true, but you know, you make it sure that you do a really good job of without boring people, but you do a good job of like, well, this is to the best of this person's recollection, that kind of stuff. It adds a real believable nature to the whole everything you're reading, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's also, I mean, if you were writing the introduction I wrote for the book, one thing I've noticed is that, like, you know, it's like 20 or 30 years later when I was writing this. A lot of the people were dead. Yeah. A lot of the people at the time were already dead. So obviously they couldn't speak for themselves. And, you know, with the passage of time, you know, people, you know, getting messed up on drugs and alcohol, or people having falling out or whatever, you know, human memory just becomes a very curious thing. And you convince yourself that something is true. You may misremember it. I don't know. One of the more interesting exercises other than that was the story of Wayne's last recording session with Alice in Chains in 1998, when they all met up in a studio in L.A. with Dave Jordan and his crew. Now, I had something like five or six sources in that room. So all Jordan's people and I can't remember who else. Yeah, I think it was all Jordan's people and Sean's drum tech. And, you know, and I asked him, you know, Wayne showed up super late, right? Because at that point, his drug use had more or less warped his perception of time. So, I mean, he's on time, and to other people, he's hours or days late, you know? So anyway, I asked people, you know, they all sit around there waiting for Wayne to show up. And like, I asked like five or six different people that question, and I got five or six different times. It's very, you know, somebody says like, oh, he showed up at 5, showed up at 11, showed up at 3, showed up at 3 in the morning, showed up at like, you know, I was like, dude, I can't even freaking tell anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they were all there, you know, it kind of makes it more mind-boggling. but yeah. So it was just one of those things where I just sort of like, well, I just know that sources had varying accounts as to what time he showed up. But yeah, so that's, I mean, it's like I said, ultimately, I don't think people are deliberately lying to me. I think that's how they remember it, or at least that's what they think they remember.
Sure.
You know, in my case, I was obviously operating with the benefit of hindsight. I was obviously operating with, you know, the knowledge of other people in some cases. Like, I'd already interviewed them, or I'd already researched the subject, or I'd already gone through archives, like newspaper clippings or magazine clippings or whatever. So I could cross-reference, you know, dates with events and whatever. So, you know, I had to sort of try and referee everything, basically. I had to make sure, you know, what the order and timing and things of events was. And, you know, it's complicated and it can be incredibly frustrating. But, you know, I mean, like I said, it's just because things don't check out, or there's some ambiguity or confusion or contradiction there, I don't think it necessarily means that people were lying to me. I just think it's, you know, it's just human nature that, you know, people forget or they misremember things as they get older.
Let me take you back a little bit. How old would you have been then, like, when Facelift or Dirt came out? Like, did you get into Alice in Chains right away? Were you into grunge, that kind of stuff? What's your background with the music?
Okay, so Facelift dropped in August of 1990. At that point, I would have been 11. I was living in Europe at the time. I was living in Holland. And at the time, you know, my sort of main musical sort of influence and sort of source of everything was the European version of MTV, which is basically very similar to the American version, just with British sensibilities, with British hosts, and sort of tailored to British and European audiences. Like, there are like some like European bands and British bands and things that were big over there at the time that didn't get the time of day in the States, and vice versa. So I discovered fairly early on was like 120 Minutes, which used to be on at like Sunday night at like midnight. And, you know, you have school on Monday morning, right? But I would sneak out of bed and go watch it for a little while. And a lot of the bands I still listen to today are from that period. So how did I discover Alice in Chains? I don't remember the brouhaha over Facelift for some reason. I'm not saying I didn't hear it. I'm just saying I just don't remember it. I do remember when Nirvana.
You were 11. Come on.
I do remember the brouhaha when Nirvana and Pearl Jam came, because Nevermind and 10 came out about a month apart, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
And that was like a year later. And, And that those albums, everybody was listening to it, you know what I mean? So, and then came out like shortly after. So as far as how it was Allison Chains, it would have been either 120 Minutes or Headbangers Ball or Abuse and Butthead, like one of those shows is how I discovered Allison Chains back in the day. So,
okay. Well, we going back even a little bit more, because you touch on it in the book, you know, because they came out about a year before everything broke with grunge, and that record really didn't hit. And now, when they were first starting making kind of some noise in Seattle, they were kind of tagged as kind of a pretty typical metal band of the time, opening for bands like Great White and Tesla and that kind of thing in Seattle when they came through town. I got the impression, I just doing this show, listening to that music from the time, you know, I was 21, 20 during all that stuff happened. It seems like they benefited a lot from not hitting right away. Like if they would have, if Facelift would have taken off right out of the gate, and then a year later Nirvana happens, I think things could have been a little bit different for them. But they really started getting traction just ahead of Nirvana breaking, and things were starting to kind of shift there. You know, with Man in the Box, I think the video came out early '91 or something like that. But that was kind of when things happened, and then when Nirvana did break. So I don't know. Did you get that impression too? Kind of researching this.
So if I remember, before Alice came out, remember Alice was the Manic Racism Silver at that point, who was also, besides dating and later marrying Chris Cornell, she was also managing Soundgarden.
Right.
So when Alice finished Facelift and they were about to go on that first tour, Soundgarden were coming off of Louder Than Love. And so that was sort of like, that first sort of hit, I think he got a Grammy nomination. It didn't get a ton of MTV play, but it was really sort of a shot in the arm, and that sort of set the stage for Soundgarden when they went into the studio to do Bad Motorfinger.
Yeah.
Seattle was the ball was already rolling, so to speak. So then Alice in Chains went out, and we do the Man of the Box video, which is the second single off the record. The first one didn't it got played on like metal stations, but it didn't really sort of have that kind of breakout
We Die Young
that Man of the Box did. Right. So
I don't remember that as a single at all, Dave. I was kind of paying attention to that, you know, so I was surprised actually reading this book and researching this record to get that information, because you just talked about events that are old. That's my 30 years ago brain, but I really don't recall that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just like, it clearly didn't make any movement is all.
I mean, I had to thank God for YouTube, because, you know, all those videos were online. I could dig them up and watch them, you know?
Yeah.
One of my sources that I interviewed quite extensively was Rocky Shank, who was this artist and video director who collaborated quite extensively with the band over the years. And so he directed, besides doing the artwork for the records, he directed that video for We Die Young. So he told me some really interesting stories about that. It was a house in, I want to say, in Glendale. It had burned down in a fire. And so it's like the house is like, you know, it's a wreck, and there's like debris and stuff in the swimming pool, whatever. And so they hired this family, like they hired the location from this family, the owner that owned it, so they could shoot the video. And then they're like, okay, well, let's put some of this debris and stuff in the pool, you know, because there are scenes they shot in the swimming pool and things like that. And they're like children's toys and things like that. And all these things. And we're like, oh my God, what are you doing? You know? So that was kind of an interesting, first experience. And again, keep in mind, they weren't famous at that point. He was doing it on a shoestring budget because he liked them.
Yeah.
Same deal with the photo shoot for their album cover. And there's a photo shoot of them. If you look at the inside liner notes of Facelift, there's a photo of them on this mound of yellow dust or dirt. It's sulfur. It was at a factory outside of LA or something like that. And so, you know, the wind is shifting, and every so often they'd all start crying because it's gotten their eyes or whatever. And so So anyway, but that photo shoot was from the same. And it's like, I think it's the interior photo of Facelift. And that's, Yeah, that's Rafi Shank for you right there. So, but as far as back to your original question about, you know, the Man of the Box being a breakout, I think it was the right game, the right place at the right time. I mean, I wrote about one of the chapters in there was about the meeting of the MTV executives where they decided, you know, which new video was going to get this sort of this seal of approval, this buzz bin or whatever.
Yeah, I love that story.
The seal of approval. And,
do you remember the other artist?
It was a band called Blue Murder.
Yeah,
Jelly Roll. Jelly Roll or Valley of the King, one of those two.
Just quick note on that: when we went through the facelift record for this sidecast, I brought that story up from your book because I just can't imagine. I mean, it's down to those two. It seems it's almost like just ridiculous to think. Because, you know, I don't know if you know much about Blue Murder, but you got Carmine Appice and John Sykes, two guys who are basically they're old, and they're probably already in their next bands by the time MTV is talking about this. You know, they just move around all the time. They don't really seem like the kind of band that gets in the buzz bin, but love to get that little nugget from your book.
Yeah, and so, you know, apparently, if you look at the video for Man in the Box, it's like so dark and so weird. It's like a black and white sepia tone. There's this weird guy with his eyes sewn shut.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it was just so bizarre. It's like, let's just pick something different. That was really their deciding factor. I love that.
You have Lane's treatment for the video in the book, too. That was brilliant. Rainy, drippy barn, farm animals, and babies with eyes shut.
Yeah, Paul Rockley, the director, decided the babies with eyes shut wasn't going to be doable. So they came up with the idea of having this, like, guardian, you know, this guy he knew who kind of looked like Jesus with his eyes shut, acted sort of like a caretaker for the animals who run the barn. So that's the guy you see there. And Lane later got that, you know, the Man of the Box tattooed on his right shoulder blade, if I remember correctly. So but as far as the impact that video had on the band, it was huge. I mean, they were in the middle of a Clash of the Titans tour, which is a strange story in and of itself. You know, three thrash metal bands and Alice in Chains. And, you know, the crowd hated them at first. You know, the Slayer fans are notorious. There's an episode where they were just throwing jugs and beer cans and everything they could throw at them. You know, I think it was at Red Rocks in Colorado. And, you know, literally within a couple of weeks later, I mean, they were the biggest band on that bill. You know, and so, you know, life has a...
I saw that tour.
Way of taking its turn, yeah. Oh, cool. Where'd you go?
I went to it in Minnesota in a place called Shroud Air. It's about an hour north of St. Paul, the Twin Cities there, so... they killed it, man. That was actually my first time. I mean, I think I knew the song Man in the Box, but I really hadn't had it bought all in. But it wouldn't be long, that's for sure. But I loved the entire day. All four bands kicked ass.
And then so Man in the Box was sort of this big hit of the summer. And then for the fall they get the nod to open for Van Halen. And so right when I think in August or September of 1991, they get their gold record for 500,000 copies sold, which was the first of those Seattle Grunge records to reach that mark. And that was also the same month that either Nevermind or 10 came out.
Okay.
So needless to say, it was kind of like they set the bar, and then those other guys cleared it.
and Dave Jordan coming in to produce, there's a really good story in the book about that. The story is that Dave was arranged to meet them and see them play in L.A., and it was only like Dave, Rick Rubin, and a couple other people there totally, and Rick Rubin walks out.
Yeah. What might have been?
I wanted to ask you, did you know if Rick was there for, like, to actually scout the band for his own deal, or was he just, like, hanging out?
I didn't interview Rick Rubin. My impression from what I call my interview with Dave Jordan was that they were both there checking out Alice in Chains, because at that point, they were sort of this hot new band, and the record label, which was CBS at that time, later merged and became Columbia. But CBS was sort of shopping their demo around to like every like hard rock and metal producer in town, mm-hmm. and I guess Jordan and Rubin were like the only two that showed up.
Oh, And Rick probably wasn't happy with what he saw.
I'm not 100% sure. I'm not 100% sure that. That's just my impression. And again, you have to ask Rick that. But, what might have been. I mean, at that point, Jordan, he'd done a whole bunch of stuff with different bands over the years. But for the intensive purposes of his work with Alice, what they were most excited about, what was most relevant, was that he had done the Jane's Addiction album, Nothing Shopping.
Right.
And I think they had just finished Ritual to Love Ritual. So, I mean, that was the sort of point of reference, because what I was told by Ronnie Champagne, who was Dave's engineer on Facebook, was like, they were all sort of, they're all kids, they're all sort of curious. It was the first time in the studio with a budget and making an album, and so they're like, wow, what are they doing on this track? What did you guys do on this? Because they were all asking about Jane's Addiction, basically.
Okay. Yeah, you bring that up in the book. That's kind of cool. It's weird because those aren't two bands that sound much alike.
Yeah, I thought it was. I think it was. I mean, they mentioned that I may have over dramatized it a little bit, but I think it's in the book. Check in the chapter on the making of Facelift. But that would be where it is.
Sure.
Because it's one of those things where, I mean, Nothing Shocking came out in 1988, and I think Ritual came out in 1990, if I remember correctly. So they were
sounds right.
Like they had just finished Ritual. They went and did Facelift, and so they had the early mixes of Ritual, and the Alice guys were listening to it.
Wow,
if I remember correctly, yeah.
One thing that also kind of comes through when we're talking about the recording is that we see a little bit. It's how I read it, but Mike Starr comes off a little bit more naive than the other guys when it comes to stuff. When you tell the story about how he doesn't know how to really properly work his own bass gear, he just kind of turns the knobs up and stuff.
I think he was self-taught as a musician. Well, I mean, I think all of those guys were to some degree or another. He did. I mean, in terms of the pre-Alice band, I would say Seda was the one that was probably had the biggest following, the biggest local success. Like, they won a bunch of Battle of Bands. They recorded demos. They got a song on the Northwest Metal Fest compilation. But they had choreographed moves. They had Pyro. They had all this stuff. So, I mean, he was alive before. He was doing this while he was in high school, I think, if I remember correctly. So Mike, in those respects, I'd say when Alice formed, he was the guy with the most hands-on experience, interestingly enough. I think what he didn't, this is my personal impression here, but I think what he didn't know until he got in the band and until when it became a business, for example, was how much work it was to be in a band. You have to rehearse. You got to keep writing songs. And I mean, I don't know, but that was sort of an issue where Jerry was, clearly the if this band is the Who, Jerry's Pete Townsend. And he's got to write on almost everything. And, when Mike learned, after the hit was success of the first album, that writing songs meant publishing money and meant bigger paychecks. He wanted more, but I guess he just didn't know how to do it. And I think that was, I don't know. I mean, I think that might have been one of those things where a lack of formal instruction might have, in the long term, been a negative. I mean, I don't know the full extent of his musical development, but I mean, if he was self-taught, he had good ear training and whatever, but
he was a great player. I loved him as a player and a performer. It just seemed like when it came to kind of the more of the behind the scenes kind of stuff is where he kind of was out of his element. Yeah. And it's during this recording, this record, that they actually put duct tape over the knobs so he won't mess with them.
Yeah,
I mean, anybody who's been in a band had at least one guy on stage you wanted to do that to.
I think they even took a knife or something and they carved the settings into the amp pad, so they knew
put it back.
What to set it at. Yeah,
Oh, man. Well, Susan Silver said something to the effect that, he was the hardest to rein in, like, with money and stuff, right?
Yeah, he, I mean, remember, I think if you look at the credits for that first record, I think Jerry had his fingerprints on most, if not all of it. Lane had a couple of writing credits for lyrics, but otherwise I think it was all Cantrell. I think Mike had a credit on, I think it's like, It Ain't Like That and Confusion. I think those are the two songs he has a credit on. And I don't know. So, but I know that when he got money, he paid, he bought a car. I can't remember the model, but it's in the book. He bought a car and he paid whatever, $35,000, whatever it was, he paid cash, for this new car. So, you know, I don't, and then, you know, I don't know what he, I don't know how much other money he was getting from, you know, royalties or if he had endorsements with, you know, Spectre or any other instrument company or whatever. So, but, you know, they weren't thinking of how do I grow this money? How do I make it last or whatever? It was, okay, I got to spend it. Now, Lane, on the other hand, was exactly the opposite. He was very conservative in how he spent his money. Yes, he splurged on toys and video games and stuff, but you know, he got an account.
And heroin.
But he didn't fall into that trap of, like, well, I'm a big rock star. I made it now.
Give me Ferraris and a mansion in Bellevue. I'm going to throw a joke at you once in a while, just a heads up. Yeah, I get where you're going. Yeah.
Go for it. Yeah, The story is too dark not to joke about it.
Hey, you know, a little side note there. Yeah, because heroin comes up a lot when we're talking about grunge. I'm about halfway through the list, and there are times where it's just like, Jesus, fuck, I need to kind of give myself a little break. Because, you know, I want to kind of keep things light and celebrate this music, but, man, it does get dark. I wanted to ask you another thing about Mike Starr real quick. Now, legend has it, and you do touch on it in the book. I'm just curious if this is one of those stories where you openly admit you're not exactly sure how true it is. I'm just curious what level of corroboration you might have got that Mike Starr actually dropped Andrew Wood off at what would be his last drug buy and eventual overdose. I hope I'm not saying that wrong.
That's what he told Mark Yarn, who's the author of Everything Loves Our Town, and if you read that book.
Yep.
That's where I got that quote. And you know, again, how do you prove a negative, right? That something didn't happen. I mean, right. Am I gonna go CSI, my star, okay, he dropped him off, whatever. I mean, I couldn't, that's one of those things where I couldn't prove or disprove it, you know what I mean? And it's like sometimes I can. And other times you just have to take it with a grain of salt. That's one of those things where we may never know.
So it's strictly from there and nothing else. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly when Mike died or specifically when you started this. When you started the book, would he have still been alive or would he have already passed?
No, he died. I started the book in like September of 2011 and he died like 6 months earlier.
Okay. All right.
Missed him.
Well, there is a huge ripple effect that because things really hadn't kind of grown to where it eventually would. I don't think it was nationally known. At least I can tell you from my perspective, being in Minnesota, it wasn't. But you get it. You do a great job of tying it all together in the book. When we talk about what Andrew Wood's death actually did, and it really didn't have the effect that it probably should have, which would have been a bit of a wake up call. It was more like the first domino, and it took a while until people started taking a little more seriously. It seems like I'm talking about, of course, overdosing, that kind of deal.
Yeah. And it wasn't just Alice in Chains either. I mean, it was Ian died of a, you know, I think Mark Arm from Mudhoney also dabbled in it. Shannon Hoon from Glenn Mellon. Who else?
Lanigan from Screaming Trees.
Lanigan, Screaming Trees, yeah.
His book has some really dark, very open and honest stories of abuse.
I haven't read it yet, but I've heard it's maybe too honest.
Yeah, possibly.
So I mean, the thing about Andrew's death is, like, he sort of, you know, he became sort of the Sid Barrett of Seattle, in the sense that, you know, it's like, you know, Pink Floyd used, you know, the loss of Sid and his, you know, breakdown and everything as to inspire their work. You know, all the how many songs did they write about Sid, and, you know, the whole Wish You Were Here album, obviously. And so, you know, boom, there you go, Alice, James Cone cranks out with Wood, and then Camelbox is Far Behind, and then, you know, Cornell, yeah, you know, starts writing these songs that become Temple of the Dog, and yada, yada, yada. You know, it's, you know, he's one of those sort of larger-than-life figures, and, you know, you can't help but wonder what might have been.
Yeah, and I love Mother Love Bone, but I just didn't see, like, when I listened to it, which was posthumous, it doesn't come across as this thing that has that mass appeal that these other bands did. Now, who knows what would have happened? I might feel differently if they had a chance to break, but man,
Eddie Vedder would still be pumping gas in San Diego.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, so we got one of those great, you know, what if. Those great cosmic questions that you will never know what everyone might have done.
No doubt.
Here's another great like what if. If you ever read Duff McKagan's memoir, you know, he left Seattle. He came up in the Seattle punk scene. You know, he played his band, performed in the Metropolis and whatever. And I think in like 1985, whatever, he leaves for LA, and then he, you know, starts Guns N' Roses, right? And so it's funny. So Guns takes off. And then Grunge takes off a couple of years later, but he remember him staying or writing somewhere, and he always wondered what might have been if he had stayed. Like, maybe he would have wound up in Soundgarden. You know, he wondered that.
No, I wonder.
Think about that. What might have been? You know, so it's, yeah.
There was a very tight community there. I mean, as I every record I go forward, there's like a half a dozen names that come up constantly on this list, you know, people that have worked,
yeah.
You know, I mean, like you mentioned, Susan Silver managing some of these bands. Jack and Dino produced a bunch of the artists on this list. You know, Sub Pop Records was, of course, involved in a lot of the CZ records. There's just so many layers to these things where, you know, I mean, the Matt Cameron has been in about 10 of these bands, you know.
It was a very small circle, just a bunch of people who were playing music for themselves and their friends. And, you know, and I think if you look at those early grunge records, those, you know, from say like 85 to like I didn't even include Nevermind in that list. There is an innocence and I think an integrity to all those records, just because there were no expectations of fame or success or fortune or whatever. They were doing it for themselves. It was what they liked. It was what their audience liked. You know, and it developed very organically and very far away from the corrupting influence of the industry. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, so by the time that they, you know, these guys are all going supernova, right. You know, boom, never, if you look at that timeline right there, and you look at, you know, Facelift, you know, Nevermind, 10, Bad Motor Finger, Dirge, you know, it's like they're boom, 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 they're cranking out one after the other, and you add, you know, Smashing Pumpkins and Hole and all these other sort of grunge contemporary bands.
Stone Temple Pilots.
And it's just like, you're just like, wow, you know, there's just this. It just seems like every 6 weeks or something, somebody was dropping a masterpiece, you know what I mean? And, but especially for that actual Seattle community, that little tight-knit thing. And then, you know, I guess, you know, once that cat got out of the bag, I mean, you know, the best analogy I've heard, Alex explained that was like sort of like California after the gold rush. You know, everybody was coming over. Everybody was coming to Seattle.
then it's the music industry at that point. Well, you know, another thing too about all that is that, like, they would actually do like collaborative side projects that were good. You know what I mean? Like Mad Season and Temple of the Dog. It just seemed like the reason for doing all these things was effortless and pure. It wasn't like about some kind of commercialization. Of course, I'm being a little probably, I don't know, Pollyannic about that, but.
Well, no, Temple of the Dog for sure. I mean, like I said, it was meant to be a tribute to Andy Wood. And it didn't sound like Soundgarden, And so,
and that had that was a slow grow too. That was out quite a bit before hunger strike hit.
Well, yeah, because at that point, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden had blown up, and then like the label realized, like, holy shit, I got this record, we got this record, and like the Soundgarden guys and the Pearl Jam guys together, let's do cocky shit, you know?
Yeah.
And there you go. So it was like one of those things where it had this little diamond in the rough, and they didn't realize it until, you know, a year later. But as far as Matt Stevens goes, I mean, remember that started with McCready in rehab in Minnesota, where he meets Baker Saunders, and you know, he comes up with this idea, and he wants to, you know, sort of lead by example and, you know, being sober and whatever, and he wants to help Wayne get sober. You know what I mean? So it started with, I wouldn't say it started with good intentions, but it certainly wasn't innocent intentions in that respect. You know what I mean?
Right.
So they were, yeah.
Because it seems clear that Lane needed help pretty early on in the recording, and the fact that they kind of plowed through it. I guess you got a pretty good point there.
I don't know. I mean, my personal view on Lane's drug use is, I think that he had over, you know, since he was like a teenager until he was an adult, he was pretty, I guess, strong tolerance for stuff like alcohol or drugs or whatever, and he just didn't affect him, whatever. And then, for whatever reason, once he tried heroin, that was it.
And you mentioned that the Van Halen tour in 91 there, at the end of the facelift cycle, that supposedly was when, what's her name? Is it Demery? Is that how you pronounce it?
Demery.
So that's when she would have, supposedly the first time she, you know, had Lane try heroin. I'm not phrasing that right. I'm not trying to blame somebody, but she was like the conduit to his first exposure, I guess.
That's how that story came from Johnny Bacolus, who was, in addition to being in Lane's previous band, he was in the Grom band, yes, Sleeve, now Thing Change. He was also his roommate at the time of the Mad Season record. So they lived together for about a year, 15 months, give or take. Yeah. And so, you know, they had been friends since they were teenagers, right? So they're like 15, 16, right? And so, you know, when they were living together, he asked him, you know, how'd you get started on this? And that's the story that Lane told him. And, you know, the fact that, you know, it was in that particular context, it was one of his closest childhood friends, and it was a private conversation between the two of them, that would incline me to think that he was telling the truth.
Wow.
So, I mean, and again, I don't think, and as far as the blame, because I addressed that in the book right there, I mean, you know, Lane was no saint. I mean,
right. That's kind of what I was trying to say. Is it?
He had been battling drugs for years. I mean, the stuff that I was able to find was, you know, marijuana, cocaine, acid, and I think probably mushrooms, if I remember correctly. That's just the stuff that we knew about. You know, and the other thing to keep in mind also is that when he was still at the Music Bank, and at some point in 1988, one of the other musicians there offered him and another guy heroin, and they both turned him down.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was an interesting, and I asked him that. That story was known to other people who worked at the Music Bank or who were around that team at the time. And so, you know, for whatever reason, in 1988, despite, you know, having, you know, been dabbled in other drugs, you know, Lane knew that he was going to draw the line at heroin. Like, nope, I'm not going to try it. And then 3 years later, for whatever reason, he tries it, and I have not been able to determine why he changed his mind, why he decided to do it. But the other thing I would say as well is that even if it hadn't been Demery, you know, there's no way to prove this. This is pure speculation. This is a pure what if. But, you know, my personal view is that if Demery hadn't introduced him to it at that point, it would have been somebody else. You know, it was there, and it was endemic to the scene. You know, it could have been, you know, anybody from another band. It could have been, you know, a mutual dealer. Who knows? But it just, you know.
And there might be the reason that he eventually tried it years later, even though he once thought that's just the one taboo, is that it was just becoming too common in the scene that he was in, you know?
Possibly. I mean, you'll remember that, you know, Demi had she was sort of seeing a guy while Lane was on tour. This is another musician who was also a heroin addict.
Yeah, what was his name? I'm sorry, that comes up in the book, too.
So the guy's name is Dwayne Lance Bodenheimer.
And he was in a local band still at the time, and he was just kind of, I don't know, grinding on Demery when Lane was on the road.
I guess so. I mean, keep in mind, Lane was having his fun as well.
Yeah, so of course, like, yeah.
You know, he had much moral ground to claim in that argument either. He denied it, but Lane heard enough. And so what happened was at the single shoot in, I guess, in the spring of 91, Allison Payne is filming their scene. The Cameron Crowe's people have built a makeshift stage by the pier. It's not an actual club. It's just something that they built just for the movie and that took it down. And so when they were shooting that scene, and it was like an all-night shoot or something, you know, just doing take after take after take. And so Bodenheimer was there, and I'm looking at my book right now. And so, you know, Lane saw Bodenheimer, and then he sort of just confronted him. And, you know, he just, you know, man, just let him have it, you know. And he said, and I'm quote, and this is the quote I have in my book, I'm reading it right now. Quote, "You're a piece of shit. It should have been you that died instead of Andy Wood. I fucking hate you."
Nice.
Now, obviously, at that point, he knew that Bodenheimer was a heroin user. It was like a year after Andy Wood had died. Obviously, he hadn't dabbled in it yet because obviously he felt like he had some sort of moral, I don't know, authority or something
Well, he's anger and lashing out. You know, I think he's probably angry.
Yeah. And so, in Bodenheimer, what he told me was, Lane said it to me, and that was very hurtful. It hurt me. It wasn't like a total dick. I did have feelings. I felt bad about what was going on, but I couldn't help it because I really did love her. So, I mean, for whatever reason, at some point, you know, even, you know, a couple of months before that Van Halen tour, I mean, he's acting, you know, he's talking pretty high and mighty to this guy about his heroin problem, and then he tries it himself.
Oh, I getcha.
So, I mean, why he decided to try it after all that, I have no idea.
I really appreciate you tying in that timeline there from that argument to the Van Halen thing.
This was March of 91 in that shoot, and the Van Halen tour was like August.
Right.
So it was like 5 months later.
I was surprised reading your book that Andrew Wood actually lived for a little bit after his OD, and all these people like Chris Cornell came back to see him in the hospital. That is a heartbreaking, I don't know, couple pages in the book.
Yeah, I put together that account from a couple of other grunge books. So it was like the Pearl Jam 20 book. It was Mark Yarm, Greg Platto's histories of the grunge scene. And then there's a great documentary about Andrew Wood called Malfunction.
Story
by a guy named Scott Barber. Yeah. So that's, I kind of sort of put it together from all those accounts, right? So, I guess he was alive in the sense that he had a pulse or whatever, but I don't think he was conscious. I mean, he was on a ventilator, you know, he was on tubes. I mean, he was in a medically induced coma, if I remember correctly.
Right.
So, I mean, and I guess at a certain point they just decided that it was just too much and you know, the best thing to do would have been to pull the plug, and that's ultimately what happened. It was just a sad scene. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what it must have been like being in that hospital. That's drug overdose for you.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.